This is Common Ground, a program on world affairs and the people who shape events.
I have no doubt that the presence of the mission did mitigate the incidence of human rights violations. There were not as many cases of arbitrary arrest, torture, as there would have been had we not been there. And when they did occur, we were able to intervene, again, with at least some degree of effectiveness.
Monitoring human rights abuses in Haiti on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. ''93 looked to be a promising year for the restoration of democracy in Haiti. Father Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the popularly elected priest overthrown by a military coup in 1991, was set to return to the island in October. But the UN brokered agreement for his return fell apart just days before his scheduled arrival in Haiti. Many foreigners working in Haiti at the time were forced to flee the country, including a group of civilian human rights observers who'd been monitoring abuses for most of 1993. That joint mission of the UN and the Organization of American States was led by Ian Martin, the former director of Amnesty International. He recounts the chain of events that led to their forced evacuation from the island in October.
There had been an increasing series of threats to our own observers and incidents, not infrequently, involving our observers being threatened with armed weapons. None of our observers was ever physically attacked or hurt. But then the hopes of the constitutional government and others was that the situation on the ground would improve with the deployment of the military and police components of the United Nations mission. The first contingent of Canadian police had arrived and were waiting to be deployed. And the first large contingent of mostly American military were due to arrive as a military assistance training mission. The Harlan County, which was the vessel that was bringing those U.S. troops, was withdrawn after a demonstration by armed men at the port. That had a dramatic psychological impact on the island. It was an enormous psychological victory for the extreme right, who had been digging in and organizing to prevent the return of the president, an enormous abandonment for the majority of Haitians who were committed to that transition. It led on directly to the withdrawal of the Canadian police, because the Canadian government then felt that if the US government had withdrawn their part of the mission, that the police part could not remain. So on the Tuesday, the Harlan County turned back. On the Thursday morning, the Canadian police left. On the Thursday afternoon, the Minister of Justice, Maître Guy Mallory, was gunned down in the streets of Port-au-Prince, and that evening the decision was taken to evacuate the civilian mission that had become the remaining part of the international presence. And although, of course, we had been there before the military and the police, our own situation had become more vulnerable as a result of the unsuccessful attempt to put in the military and the police.
It was a very discouraging end to that mission, which had begun with such hopes earlier in the year.
Well, at the end of 1992, beginning of 1993, there was a fresh initiative in which the United Nations became directly involved, as well as the OAS, to resolve the political crisis in Haiti. And in January 1993, President Aristide addressed a letter to the Secretaries General of the UN and the OAS, asking them to deploy an international civilian mission to try to bring about an improvement in the human rights situation on the ground as a step towards an overall political settlement. And that was agreed to by the two organizations. They negotiated with the de facto authorities in Haiti.
The military rulers.
The military, but also at that point there was a de facto prime minister whose legitimacy was not recognized by the international community. So they obtained agreement in principle to the deployment of that mission. There was quite a tough argument about its terms of reference and the rights it would have to have access to prisoners and places of detention and so on, but eventually that was agreed. And so from February 1993 onwards, the mission was deployed. It was to build up eventually to 280 human rights observers spread throughout the country. In fact, it had never reached its full number before it was evacuated in mid-October, but at that point we had nearly 200 human rights personnel across Haiti, which is the largest human rights monitoring operation that international organizations have ever put on the ground.
This was a fairly new kind of mission, wasn't it? I mean, there aren't too many precedents for the mission that you were heading.
No, I think the closest precedents are in El Salvador, where the United Nations deployed a human rights verification mission even before there was a full political settlement, still there at this moment, and in Cambodia, where UNTAG, the United Nations Transitional Authority in Cambodia, had a human rights component of part of their overall operations. There were some similarities with our work and the work of those human rights operations, especially El Salvador, because the Haiti terms of reference were very similar to those of El Salvador, but some very big differences in the political context we were operating in as well.
Who was on the mission with you? What were you? Were you mainly including human rights experts?
Well, we recruited people who had already strong experience in human rights monitoring, human rights work. We also had people who were recruited from their knowledge of Haiti, because the ability to function not only in French but also in Creole was important. So we had people who had been in Haiti before as Peace Corps observers or as observers during the elections when President Aristide was elected. It was a very mixed group of people. We had more than 50 nationalities represented in the mission.
And what exactly was the mandate of the mission? Was the return of Father Aristide ever one of your missions?
That wasn't within the mandate of the civilian mission itself. That was the objective of the overall international process. So we were a part of an international operation mounted by the UN and the OAS, whose commitment certainly was to bring about the return to constitutional government, the return of President Aristide. But our specific mandate was to promote the respect for human rights, with particular reference to the right to life, the right to physical integrity, the right not to be tortured, that's to say, and the right to freedom of expression and association. Those were the human rights that our mandate focused on.
Well, how did you go about carrying out your mission on the ground then?
We deployed teams throughout Haiti in each of the 9 departments and indeed some sub-offices as well. They established contact with the local community in all its aspects, with local officials, there were still local elected officials, judicial officials, the military themselves, non-governmental organizations, the church, which is obviously a very important network in the countryside, explained the mandate of the mission, made clear that the mission was open to receive information, complaints of specific human rights violations, sent teams out into the rural areas, sometimes involving extremely long journeys on foot or on pony to penetrate the rural areas of Haiti, and then to put back to the military the mission's concern about human rights violations that have been reported to it, get their view of those, and insist on respect for the constitution of Haiti, which has very good human rights provisions, although they've rarely been well respected in practice, and respect for international human rights standards. Those were our mandate rested on the Haitian constitution and international human rights law.
Did you get much cooperation from the military and the police on the ground? I'm sure you weren't welcomed with open arms there.
Well, it was always difficult. The military, who include the police, because there isn't a civilian police force separate from the military, so the Haitian armed forces, in fact, carry out policing functions throughout the country, had agreed to the deployment of the mission, but of course under a great deal of international pressure. And it was always a somewhat uneasy relationship. It varied from one place to another. There were some military commanders on the ground who were very correct and proper in their relationships with the mission. There were others whose hostility to the mission was barely concealed. And quite quickly, we had difficulties with the terms of reference of the mission being respected in practice. On paper, we had the right of immediate access to people who'd been arrested, who might be being tortured. Often that access was impeded, delayed. The terms of reference guaranteed that anyone in contact with the mission should have their own security protected by the authorities, and yet we found that all too often people were intimidated or victimized because they'd been in contact with the mission. So there was never the full degree of real cooperation that we would have wanted.
So these people were being bothered while you were still there because they'd had contact with you, or is this something you've discovered since you've returned?
Both. While the mission was there, we had all too many examples of people who'd been in contact with us who were then threatened or worse by the military, or perhaps even more often by the attachés, the kind of armed thugs who operate with the military. But one of the extremely unhappy aspects of our evacuation in the middle of October was that we were abandoning people who had been in contact with the mission, fearing that they could then be the subject of reprisals, and undoubtedly that happened to some extent. Only now, with the return of a small team from the mission to Haiti, is the mission perhaps beginning to know to what extent that happened.
That must be a real dilemma for human rights workers in any country where there's a repressive regime of knowing that the people you're working with, the people who are in country, are oftentimes in jeopardy for speaking out.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's a problem even when a human rights NGO visits a country just for a one-off visit to collect information. There's always that fear that people in contact may be victimized. But of course, in the case of a United Nations OAS mission, the reasonable expectation of the Haitians was that this was a presence that was going to continue and see through a transition to a return to constitutional government, and therefore they were encouraged to cooperate with it in that expectation.
You're listening to Common Ground. It's a service of the Stanley Foundation. My guest is Ian Martin, who served as Director for Human Rights of the OAS UN International Civilian Mission in Haiti from February to October of 1993. That was before they were forced to leave the country. Martin is the former director of Amnesty International and currently a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. The Stanley Foundation is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available. Please listen at the end of this broadcast for details. What kind of effect do you think your mission had on the people in Haiti, at least while you were there? I'm sure it was demoralizing when you had to leave.
I have no doubt that the presence of the mission did mitigate the incidents of human rights violations. There were not as many cases of arbitrary arrest, torture, as there would have been had we not been there. And when they did occur, we were able to intervene, again with at least some degree of effectiveness, to get people released earlier than they would otherwise have been, to get legal representation for them. Sometimes I'm afraid to arrange medical treatment for them because of their ill treatment in custody. But we were never able to bring an end to those violations. And as tension rose towards the date set for President Aristide's return, which the military were seeking to obstruct, the number of killings in the capital, Port-au-Prince, grew. We were able to do very little about that other than...
This was in early October?
This was, well, it actually began fairly soon after the Governor's Island agreement in July. A couple of weeks into August, we were identifying that trend of an increasing number of killings and disappearances, and it doubled again in September. So it was a very serious intensification and a clear phenomenon of the operation of paramilitary armed groups targeting community activists, political activists. In Port-au-Prince, we were not able to do a great deal more than take the body count, as it were, and bring it to international attention. It was better that there were witnesses and this phenomenon was at least the subject of some international concern, rather than that it went on as it did immediately after our withdrawal, with very little knowledge of what exactly was happening.
So prior to this increase in the killings in July, was it merely the presence of the mission that you think might have cut down on the number of killings or arbitrary arrests and detentions?
Well, the human rights situation in Haiti, like the human rights situation anywhere, was intimately linked with what was happening politically or what was expected to happen politically. And at moments when the military themselves were negotiating and perhaps thought there might be a transition that was acceptable to them, then the level of violations was lower, but they were never willing to really loosen their grip and allow freedom of expression and association for the supporters of President Aristide. So whenever the popular sectors began to try to organize, that would still bring down repression upon them, even in the presence of the mission.
When you would hear that someone had been arbitrarily detained or arrested, how would you go about intervening?
By seeking immediate access to them in the caserne, in the police station or military post. Obviously, by asking those who'd arrested them why they had been arrested, and discussing whether they had been legally arrested. Haitian law requires a warrant for someone's arrest in most circumstances. Then insisting, whatever the circumstances of their arrest, that their physical integrity be respected, that they not be tortured, by insisting that they be brought before a judge, as the law requires, but very rarely happened before the presence of the mission. And very often that would result in their being taken before the judge, and the presence of the mission at that hearing would encourage the judicial officials to apply the law and act according to the law, even under the sort of intimidation to which they're subject by the military.
Do you have any sense now of how many more arbitrary detentions or murders, political murders, are happening since you left?
It's extremely hard to know that, not only because the international mission is not there, but also because the functioning of Haitian human rights NGOs has become so difficult. There is such an atmosphere of of terror on the island, accompanied with the difficulties that come from the embargo, the lack of fuel, and so on. That there's really very little information coming out of Haiti. It's clear that immediately after our withdrawal in mid-October, there was a continuing wave of repression in which many people were killed. That may have lessened somewhat once the military felt that they had re-established their grip, but I have no doubt, specific information, that that's continuing again now. And will continue whenever the military feel that their grip is threatened.
Under what circumstances would the mission go back? And is there any plans for it to return?
Well, indeed, a team from the mission have gone back at the roughly the beginning of February. A small group who are functioning so far only in and from Port-au-Prince. The mission has not yet been deployed across the countryside. And their experience will, as well as what happens on the political front, will determine whether the UN and the OAS thinks that a larger human rights mission can and should be put back in again. The real question, I think, is whether the mission will be allowed to be effective by the military, and in particular, whether Haitians feel that they can confidently be in contact with the mission in view of the threats that have been made to them when they were, and when there isn't an assurance that the international presence will continue and afford them some degree of protection in the future.
So what's happening now to change the situation in Haiti? What's the UN doing? What's the OAS doing? What's the next move?
Well, on the one hand, United Nations sanctions are in effect. They were reimposed after the military didn't step aside in October. Discussions have been going on about strengthening them further, as the governments threatened to do by mid-January if the military didn't give an indication of a change in their position. At the same time, the negotiators have been trying to re-establish the framework of the agreement of Governors Island of last July, a process whereby there would again be a constitutional prime minister, an amnesty for the military, a law to separate the police from the army, the retirement of the commander-in-chief, and the reassignment of the police chief. And eventually pave the way again to the president's return. But the latest version of that plan, which is being urged upon President Aristide, contains certainly no date for his return, and it's arguable whether it would in effect guarantee his return.
Do you think the return of President Aristide should still be the priority?
That's been the solid commitment of both the United Nations and the OAS from the beginning, because of the importance attached to not allowing a democratically elected president, in this case a president with an overwhelming electoral mandate, to be put aside by an armed coup. And I think that's a principle that it's is and ought to be extremely difficult for the international community to depart from.
Do you think certain sanctions are more desirable than others? I'm thinking of the sanctions that hurt the poor people first.
Well, in all discussions of sanctions, people would like there to be sanctions which target those individuals who are responsible for in this case, the lack of respect for the Constitution, without hitting the ordinary people. But of course, in practice, that's certainly an impossible thing to do absolutely, and difficult to do, even to any great extent. In the case of Haiti, it has meant an exemption from the oil embargo for delivery of oil for non-governmental organizations to continue to deliver food for feeding programs of NGOs. So some exemptions for humanitarian purposes. It's not an embargo anyway that applies to food, but because it's an oil embargo, the whole transportation system and to some extent the power distribution system, the electricity situation, has broken down, and that of course impedes distribution of all kinds of commodities within the country. So some attempts are being made to limit the impact on the poor and specifically target the military and their allies, but it's clear that there is a greatly increased degree of economic suffering for people, ordinary people throughout Haiti. The precise extent of that, it's hard to know without being on the ground.
What was the sense that you got from the people of Haiti? Did they feel that the sanctions, though it caused a great deal of suffering, were necessary?
When the mission was there from February until October, I would say that the attitude of the majority of the people was to say, yes, we welcome and accept sanctions and their consequences if the result of that is going to be that we get our president back. I'm not so certain that that's the situation today. I haven't been in Haiti recently to assess it. But there's always been a certain degree of cynicism that the international community isn't really serious, and if it isn't really serious about bringing about that outcome, the return of the president, then why make us suffer in the meantime? And I suspect that cynicism has grown enormously after the perceived withdrawal of the international community from its previous effort in October.
What would be a serious effort in their minds?
Well, I think there are Haitians who believe that it is easier than it really is for the international community to get the military to step aside. And quite a lot of Haitians say President Clinton only has to pick up the telephone and tell the Haitian military that he's really serious and they'll go. That's not the case, I think. On the contrary, if the use of military force is excluded, as it has been publicly from the beginning of this effort, then it may be very hard to persuade those who have the monopoly of the use of force to step aside. But there's certainly very much the feeling in Haiti that the United States in particular has not really been serious about wanting the return of President Aristide. And an overestimation of its ability to deliver that if it was serious.
Ian Martin has been our guest on Common Ground. He was the Director for Human Rights of the Joint Civilian Mission in Haiti for the UN and the Organization of American States. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. If you'd like to order a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, program number 9410. Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado. The zip code is 80203. Again, ask for program number 9410. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. And if you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation, which sponsors Common Ground, you can write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.